The word genocide was coined by secular Jew and Polish attorney Raphael Lemkin. To him, the term meant not only physical obliteration of a certain group of people, but their cultural annihilation as well. The legal concept that emerged from the 1948 UN Convention on Genocide, however, was so narrowly defined that it has rarely served as legal redress for the many horrific mass murders since World War II. In a piece titled The Bitter Fight Over the Meaning of Genocide, Linda Kinsler explores the history of the concept and how the horror unfolding in Gaza today is spurring activists to reclaim Lemkin's original and much broader concept. I'm going to read excerpts from the article, which was published in the New York Times on August 20 of this year. Linda Kinsler is a junior fellow at Harvard Society of Fellows and the author of Come to This Court and Cry, How the Holocaust Ends. Here's what Linda Kinsler writes. On February 26, 2007, the International Court of Justice handed down a decision in which they sought to determine whether Serbia had violated the Genocide Convention during the Bosnian War, when Bosnian Serb forces killed an estimated 100,000 civilians. The court declined to classify a vast majority of the Bosnian deaths as genocidal because on only one occasion did the perpetrators explicitly display the specific intent to, quote, destroy in whole or in part the group as such. That specific intent is required for a killing to be considered an instance of genocide. In that ruling, the moral force of the word genocide and the public understanding of the word had become fully detached from its relatively narrow legal meaning. Ever since the Polish lawyer Raphael Lemkin coined the word in 1944, it has been pulled taut between languages, Greek and Latin, legal and moral. In Lemkin's view, genocide encompassed a broad array of crimes committed with the intent to destroy a national, religious, racial, or ethnic group, arguing that genocide included acts not just of physical obliteration, but also of cultural annihilation. For him, it included mass killings as well as the destruction of language, traditions, monuments, artworks, archives, libraries, universities, and places of worship. Lemkin's hope was that coining the word and persuading nations to recognize it as a crime might somehow prevent it from recurring. But by the time the United Nations approved the Genocide Convention on December 9, 1948, which made genocide a crime under international law, only a shadow of Lemkin's original idea survived. After years of contentious deliberation and diplomatic negotiation, the convention limited genocide to five categories of acts: killing members of a group, causing group members serious bodily or mental harm, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children from one group to another, and, quote, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, end quote. Each one of those acts could constitute genocide, but only if committed with a specific intent to destroy a protected group. The potential applications of the convention to this day remain undeveloped and untested. For nearly 80 years, the word has been indelibly associated with the Holocaust. To invoke genocide is to immediately conjure up the memory of the destruction of the Jewish people and its associated architecture of murder, concentration camps and deportation trains, ghettos and gas chambers. This relation has at once augmented genocide's moral force and undermined its legal uses. The Holocaust is viewed both as the awful standard against which all modern atrocities must be measured, and as a supposedly unrepeatable catastrophe to which they must never be compared. The Genocide Convention effectively enshrined this paradoxical understanding of the Shoah and established a nearly impossible bar for genocidal intent based on its example. As a result, international courts have rarely recognized more recent mass killings as instances of the crime, and people seeking to have their suffering recognized as such have been bitterly disappointed. At the time of the convention, the Soviets, fearing they could be held accountable for their own domestic mass killings, objected to the protection of political groups under the convention. The Americans, worried about language that could be used to interpret a history of lynching and Jim Crow laws as a form of genocide. Thus, major powers had compromised in favor of a definition that was both narrow and opaque. By codifying genocide this way, the convention paradoxically made it far more difficult to identify and prove, amplifying the concept's rhetorical power while leaving it to the courts to determine how it would be applied. For decades to come, the jurisprudence of genocide remained conspicuously silent, while philosophical and colloquial uses of the word accumulated moral and political force. The strict legal interpretation of genocide has meant that courts might never recognize many of the worst atrocities of the past several decades as genocide. These include the killing of some 300,000 people in the Darfur region of Sudan, the murder of more than 1 million during the Nigeria-Biafra War, the Iraqi government's mass deportation and killing of an estimated 100,000 Kurds in the late 1980s, the Yazidi massacres by ISIS in 2014, and the Chinese effort to indefinitely detain, re-educate, imprison, and torture Uyghurs. China, like the United States, France, and Russia, refuses to recognize the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, shielding themselves from the court's authority. The ongoing debate over whether genocide describes the current Israeli violence in Gaza has become an occasion for politicians, scholars, activists, and lawyers to reappraise the legal architecture and the history that we have all inherited, and to begin to rethink how moral responsibility for the worst categories of crimes ought to be assigned. Over the past several months, as the ICJ has begun to weigh two cases pertaining to Israel and Gaza, protesters around the world have offered their own judgments in advance. "Stop the genocide," their posters have proclaimed. Their signs and demands have sought to mobilize the rhetorical force that genocide has accrued. But if the strict interpretation of the Genocide Convention prevails at the ICJ, it is possible that none of Israel's actions in Gaza will meet the legal definition of the crime. The Genocide Convention emerged as an immediate response to World War II. Today, its terms are being renegotiated in real time as part of an effort to bring them up to date with the last 80 years of war. One likely effect of all this activity is that the court will relax its evidentiary requirements for proving genocidal intent, loosening the legal interpretation of the special intent requirement. Legal scholar William Shabbas argues would thereby make the convention a living instrument that can be applied. There is also momentum building behind a new convention that would patch the loophole that the Genocide Convention exposed. The new convention aims to carry forward the legacy of the Polish attorney Lemkin and provide a sorely needed mechanism for innocent people to be protected from slaughter, or at the very least to seek legal recourse for their suffering. Lemkin created an important pathway for accountability, but in restricting his pursuit of justice to the courts, he largely avoided questions about how political power can hinder just outcomes. Today, we have another chance to grapple with that problem. Out of the debate over what genocide means in the courts and in the streets, a renewed sense of moral clarity may soon come. I've been reading excerpts from an article titled The Bitter Fight Over the Meaning of Genocide by Linda Kinsler, published in the New York Times on August 20, 2024. A link to the full article is posted on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm.